Welcome to Hallel Fellowship, found on the internet at hallel.info. That's hallel.info. We hope you are encouraged by the following recorded Bible study to look deeper into every word that proceeds from the mouth of God and how they were lived out in the life of Yeshua HaMashiach, often called Jesus the Christ.
What are these names that are given to them? They refer to usually a key word at the beginning of each particular reading. So in this particular one, Mishpatim is the beginning part of the verse of chapter 21. Talks about, and these are the Mishpatim. And then it continues on. So, which is, Sometimes they might be, you know, tangentially related to what the topic of this, but this is really good name for it because Mishpatim is pretty much the subject matter of this entire section. And we'll be getting into a discussion of what the full part of that is, but really good name for this particular one. So today we're going through Exodus chapter 21 through 24, the reading Mishpatim, starting in chapter 21. Now these are the ordinances which you are to set before them. If you buy a Hebrew slave, he shall serve for 6 years, but on the seventh he shall go out as a free man without payment. If he comes alone, he shall go out alone. If he is the husband of a wife, then his wife shall go out with him. If his master gives him a wife, and she bears him sons or daughters, the wife and her children shall belong to her master, and he shall go out alone. But if the slave plainly says, I love my master, my wife, and my children, I will not go out as a free man, then his master shall bring him to God. Then he shall bring him to the door or the doorpost, and his master shall pierce his ear with an awl, and he shall serve him permanently. If a man sells his daughter as a female slave, she is not to go free as the male slaves do. If she is displeasing in the eyes of her master who designated her for himself, then he shall let her be redeemed. He does not have authority to sell her to a foreign people because of his unfairness to her. If he designates her for his son, he shall deal with her according to the custom of daughters. If he takes to himself another woman, he may not reduce her food, her clothing, or her conjugal rights. If he will not do these three things for her, then she shall go out for nothing, without payment of money. He who strikes a man so that he dies shall surely be put to death. But if he did not lie in wait for him, but God let him fall into his hand, then I will appoint you a place to which he may flee. If, however, a man acts presumptuously toward his neighbor, so as to kill him craftily, you are to take him even from my altar, that he may die. He who strikes his father or his mother shall surely be put to death. He who kidnaps a man, whether he sells him or he is found in his possession, shall surely be put to death. He who curses his father or his mother shall surely be put to death. If men have a quarrel, and one strikes another with a stone or with his fist, and he does not die but remains in bed, if he gets up and walks around outside on a staff, then he who struck him shall go unpunished. He shall only pay for his loss of time, and he shall take care of him until he is completely healed. If a man strikes his male or female slave with a rod, and he dies at his hand, he shall be punished. If, however, he survives a day or two, no vengeance shall be taken, for he is his property. If men struggle with each other, and strike a woman with child, so that she gives birth prematurely, yet there is no injury, he shall surely be fined as the woman's husband may demand of him, and he shall pay as the judges decide. But If there is any further injury, then you shall appoint as a penalty life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, bruise for bruise. If a man strikes the eye of his male or female slave and destroys it, then he shall let him go free on account of his eye. If he knocks out the tooth of his male or female slave, then he shall let him go free on account of his tooth. If an ox gores a man or a woman to death, the ox shall be surely stoned, and its flesh shall not be eaten, but the owner of the ox shall go unpunished. If, however, an ox was previously in the habit of goring and its owner has been warned, yet he does not confine it, and it kills a man or a woman, the ox shall be stoned, and its owner also shall be put to death. If a ransom is demanded of them, then he shall give for the redemption of his life whatever is demanded of him. Whether it gores a son or a daughter, it shall be done to him according to the same rule. If the ox gores a male or female slave, the owner shall give his or her master 30 shekels of silver, and the ox shall be stoned. If a man opens a pit or digs a pit and does not cover it over, and an ox or donkey falls into it, the owner of the pit shall make restitution. He shall give money to its owner, and the dead animal shall become his. If one man's ox hurts another so that it dies, then they shall sell the live ox and divide its price equally, and also they shall divide the dead ox. Or if it is known that the ox was previously in the habit of goring, yet its owner has not confined it, he shall surely pay ox for ox, and the dead animal shall become his. Chapter 22. If a man steals an ox or a sheep and slaughters it or sells it, he shall pay 5 oxen for the ox and 4 sheep for the sheep. If the thief is caught while breaking in and is struck so that he dies, there will be no blood guiltiness on his account. But if the sun has risen on him, there shall be blood guiltiness on his account. He shall surely make restitution. If he owns nothing, then he shall be sold for his theft. If what he stole is actually found alive in his possession, whether an ox or a donkey or a sheep, he shall surely pay double. If a man lets a field or a vineyard be grazed bare and lets his animal loose so that it grazes in another man's field, he shall make restitution from the best of his own field and the best of his own vineyard. If a fire breaks out and spreads to thorn bushes so that stacked grain or the standing grain or the field itself is consumed, he who started the fire shall surely make restitution. If a man gives his neighbor money or goods to keep for him, and it is stolen from the man's house, if the thief is caught, he shall pay double. If the thief is not caught, then the owner of the house shall appear before the judges to determine whether he laid his hands on his neighbor's property. For every breach of trust, whether it is for ox or donkey or sheep, for clothing, or for any lost thing about which one says, "This is it," the case of both parties shall come before the judges. He whom the judges condemn shall pay double for his neighbor. If a man gives his neighbor a donkey, an ox, a sheep, or any animal to keep for him, and it dies or is hurt or is driven away while no one is looking, an oath before the Lord shall be made by the two of them that he has not laid hands on his neighbor's property, and its owner shall accept it, and he shall not make restitution. But if it is actually stolen from him, he shall make restitution to its owner. If it is all torn to pieces, let him bring it as evidence. He shall not make restitution for what has been torn to pieces. If a man borrows anything from his neighbor, and it is injured or dies while the owner is not with it, he shall make full restitution. If its owner is with it, he shall not make restitution. If it is hired, it came for its hire. If a man seduces a virgin who is not engaged and lies with her, he must pay a dowry for her to be his wife. If her father absolutely refuses to give her to him, he shall pay money equal to the dowry for virgins. You shall not allow a sorceress to live. Whoever lies with an animal shall surely be put to death. He who sacrifices to any god other than to the Lord alone shall be utterly destroyed. You shall not wrong a stranger or oppress him, for you were strangers in the land of Mitzrayim. You shall not afflict a widow or orphan. If you afflict them at all, and if he does cry out to me, I will surely hear his cry, and my anger will be kindled, and I will kill you with the sword, and your wives shall become widows, and your children fatherless. If you lend money to my people, to the poor among you, you are not to act as a creditor to him. You shall not charge him interest. If you ever take your neighbor's cloak as a pledge, you are to return it to him before the sun sets. For that is his only covering. It is his cloak for his body. What else shall he sleep in? And if it shall come about that when he cries out to me, I will hear him, for I am gracious. You shall not curse God, nor curse a ruler of your people. You shall not delay the offering from your harvest and your vintage. The firstborn of your sons you shall give to me. You shall do the same with your oxen and with your sheep. It shall be done. It shall be with its mother 7 days. On the eighth day you shall give it to me. You shall be holy men to me. Therefore you shall not eat any flesh torn to pieces in the field. You shall throw it to the dogs. Chapter 23. You shall not bear a false report. Do not join your hand with a wicked man to be a malicious witness. You shall not follow the masses in doing evil, nor shall you testify in a dispute, so as to turn aside after a multitude in order to pervert justice. Nor shall you be partial to a poor man in his dispute. If you meet your enemy's ox or his donkey wandering away, you shall surely return it to him. If you see the donkey of one who hates you lying helpless under its load, you shall refrain from leaving it to him. You shall surely release it with him. You shall not pervert the justice due to your needy brother in his dispute. Keep far from a false charge, and do not kill the innocent or the righteous, for I will not acquit the guilty. You shall not take a bribe, for a bribe blinds the clear-sighted and subverts the cause of the just. You shall not oppress a stranger, since you yourselves know the feelings of a stranger, for you also were strangers in the land of Mitzrayim. You shall sow your land for 6 years and gather in its yield, but on the seventh year you shall let it rest and lie fallow, so that the needy of your people may eat, and whatever they leave, the beasts of the field may eat. You are to do the same with your vineyard and your olive grove. 6 days you are to do your work, but on the seventh day you are to cease from labor, so that your ox and your donkey may rest, and the son of your female slave, as well as your stranger, may refresh themselves. Now concerning which I have said to you, be on your guard, and do not mention the name of other gods, nor let them be heard from your mouth. 3 times a year you shall celebrate a feast to me. You shall observe the feast of Matzot. For 7 days you are to eat matzot, as I commanded you, at the appointed time in the month of Eve. For in it you came out of Mitzrayim, and none shall appear before me empty-handed. Also you shall observe the feast of the harvest and of the firstfruits of your labors. from what you sow in the field. Also the feast of the ingathering at the end of the year, when you gather in the fruit of your labors from the field. 3 times a year, all your males shall appear before the Lord God. You shall not offer the blood of my sacrifice with unleavened bread, nor its fat of my feast to remain overnight until morning. You shall bring the choice first fruits of your soil into the house of the Lord your God. You are not to boil a young goat in the milk of its mother. Behold, I am going to send you an angel before you to guard you along your way and to bring you into the place which I have prepared. Be on your guard before him and obey his voice, and do not be rebellious toward him, for he will not pardon your transgression, since my name is in him. But if you truly obey his voice and do all I say, then I will be an enemy to your enemies and an adversary to your adversaries. For my angel will go before you and bring you into the land of the Amorites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Canaanites, and the Hivites and the Jebusites, and I will completely destroy them. You shall not worship their gods, nor serve them, nor do according to their deeds, but you shall utterly overthrow them and break their sacred pillars in pieces. But you shall serve the Lord your God, and he will bless your bread and your water, and I will remove sickness from your midst. There shall be no one miscarrying or barren in your land, and I will fulfill the number of your days. I will send my terror ahead of you and throw into confusion all the people among whom you come. And I will make all your enemies turn their backs to you. I will send hornets ahead of you, so that they will drive out the Hivites, the Canaanites, and the Hittites before you. I will not drive them out before you in a single year, that the land may not become desolate and the beasts of the field become too numerous for you. I will drive them out before you, little by little, until you become fruitful and take possession of the land. I will fix your boundary from the Red Sea to the Sea of the Philistines, and from the wilderness to the river. And I will deliver the inhabitants of the land into your hand, and you will drive them out before you. You shall make no covenant with them or with their gods. They shall not live in your land, because they will make you sin against me. For if you serve their gods, it will surely be a snare to you. Chapter 24. Then he said to Moshe, "Come up to the Lord, you and Aharon, Nadab and Abihu, and 70 of the elders of Israel, and you shall worship at a distance. Moshe alone, however, shall come near to the Lord, but they shall not come near, nor the people come up with him." Then Moshe came and recounted to the people all the words of the Lord and all the ordinances. And all the people answered with one voice and said, "All the words which the Lord has spoken, we will do." Moshe wrote down all the words of the Lord. Then he rose early in the morning and built an altar at the foot of the mountain with 12 pillars for the 12 tribes of Israel. He sent young men to the sons of Israel, and they offered burnt offerings and sacrificed young bulls as peace offerings to the Lord. Moshe took half of the blood and put it in basins, and the other half of the blood he sprinkled on the altar. Then he took the book of the covenant and read it in the hearing of the people. And they said, "All the Lord has spoken, we will do, and we will be obedient." So Moshe took the blood and sprinkled it on the people and said, "Behold, the blood of the covenant, which the Lord has made with you, in accordance with all these words." Then Moshe went up with Aharon, Nadab, and Abihu, and the 70 elders of Israel. And they saw the God of Israel, and under his feet there appeared to be a pavement of sapphire, as clear as the sky itself. Yet he did not stretch out his hand against the nobles of the sons of Israel. And they saw God, and they ate and drank. Now the Lord said to Moshe, "Come up to me on the mountain and remain there, and I will give you the stone tablets with the law and the commandment, which I have written for their instruction. So Moshe arose with Yehoshua, his servant, and Moshe went up to the mountain of God. But to the elders he said, wait here for us until we return to you. Behold, Aharon and Hur are with you. Whoever has a legal matter, let him approach them. Then Moshe went up to the mountain, and the cloud covered the mountain. The glory of the Lord rested on Mount Sinai, and the cloud covered it for 6 days. And on the seventh day, he called to Moshe from the midst of the cloud. And to the eyes of the sons of Israel, the appearance of the glory of the Lord was like a consuming fire on the mountaintop. Moshe entered the midst of the cloud as he went up to the mountain. And Moshe was on the mountain 40 days and 40 nights. Yes. We have a question.
It seems to be a contradiction, but I know it shouldn't be. And when a man strikes his male or female servant with a rod so that he dies under his hand, he shall certainly be punished. But if he remains alive a day or two, he is not punished, for he is his property. And when men strive and they shall... Okay, never mind, but I want to get into this one. But if there is injury, then you shall give life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, lash for lash. And when a man strikes the eye of his male or female servant and destroys it, he is to let him go free for the sake of the eye. And if he knocks out the tooth of his male or female servant, he is to let him go free for the sake of the tooth. So why is it if you get your eye or tooth knocked out, you're free, but here this guy gets beat and he's still a servant and he doesn't get to go free? That doesn't seem to be very fair to me.
Well, good question. So one of the things that we should look at, and it's a good place to start, is to basically get a look at the whole context of what we're looking at and then zero down into it. Because one of the things that we're stepping into, and the question that was in the beginning about Mishpatim and what that means and where that's going, is to look at what this section is, who it's addressed to, and what it's actually talking about. So we started this discussion when we were going through the Parasha Yitro, and which includes the Ten Commandments, the Ten Words, the Ten Statements, you could say the Ten Testimonies, because eventually, they're saying at the ending part of this, he's going up to get these tablets of the testimony, as they become called later on. So these are a testimony, a witness of what? Are they a witness of your destruction? Are they a witness of who the Lord is? And what is the purpose of them? So basically, we started out looking at 10 words. Now we've expanded them out to quite a bit more in this section, these chapters we just looked at. And then they're going to get expanded even further. And then even further. So they keep expanding outward. But one of those things to always look at when we're looking at, you'd say, laws, instructions, is what is the core part of it? Starting with, you know, what the intent was. Because if you don't catch what the intent was, you're going to completely miss it in the details. Completely miss it. Because what you're going to look at is back-to-back statements, just what you noted here. And it's like, well, wait a minute, that doesn't make any sense. Is, you know, well, what about if you, chop his ear off, chop his foot off? Is that not taken into account? So it would seem not, because it only mentions two items here, an eye and a tooth, if you don't catch the big picture of what this is referring to and who this is actually written to. So we're going to start with the big questions before we get into the details, because we could spend all day in the details and never actually get the point of what this section is about. So yeah, one more, and then we're going to go into the big picture.
I just wanted you to be able to touch on about an ox kills and goring. So I feel like that has to do with Hasatan. And also the door, it says come to the door. And we know that the word door is the main subject. And that, like a Messiah said, I am the door. Whoever comes to the door, we're coming to the door. And when you put an owl in your ear, it's that Christ opens your ear to hear. So we hear, you know, we obviously hear, have heard the call to the Messianic congregation. So if you want to touch on that.
I wonder if they did nose jobs too.
So you were nosy.
The nose jobs, oh boy. So as we're looking at some of the big questions of this particular topic, we have to really start with these. Because if we do not address these and spend our life in the details, you know, we are missing out on the testimony of the Lord. Because, you know, we're getting into, as this section ends, with the tablets, and they're called the tablets of the testimony. And everything we just read here today is expansions upon the tablets of the testimony. And then everything we read in Leviticus and everything we read in Deuteronomy are expansions on the tablets of the testimony. So if we are not actually getting the answers to some of these questions, like we were talking about eye for eye, tooth for tooth. Well, the surface reading of this is, you know, beyond we are talking about, well, are we talking contradictions even within the instructions themselves? One of the common themes that you'll see people bring up today is this looks like vigilantism, because you just go out, if your neighbor does this, you take him out. You take him down. He takes your stuff, you take it back. And he takes some stuff, you take back even more than he stole. That's what it looks like on the surface. And in another question we need to answer, are these laws, these judgments, these mishpatim, are they ignorant? Ignorant of how the world really works? Are they obsolete? As we're talking about donkeys and all kinds of agricultural stuff and practices that people don't even do anymore. So are they obsolete? And you know, I guess spurring from that is, what do these things actually mean for us today? So one of the things we're talking about in the outset of understanding the core principles, the core intent, before getting into the details, one of the things that we encounter today is when you have judges or you have interpretations of laws, you know, talking secular laws today. And you will look at things on the surface and you wonder, well, how on earth could they possibly get to that particular decision from where they started, from what it actually says? Well, if you don't understand what the intent was to begin with, you may not understand why it was there. And if the intent was bogus to begin with, well, then maybe it's bogus and needs to be discarded. But if the intent was pure and the intent was noble, then maybe there needs to be a little bit of a realignment in how we approach our views of the law. And what are the, when you talk about we had the 10 words in our last reading, what are, you could say, the two words, or the two statements that Messiah Yeshua broke them all down to? Said that all of the law and the prophets hang upon two. Yes. Yes, Louise?
Were you asking a question? What are the two important statements?
Yes, what are they?
Okay, number one, to love God. And number two, to love each other.
Okay. There's love God, love each other. And then, you know, specifically, you've got them expanded into, you know, love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your strength. Those are key, important. You know, Messiah, you know, added in their mind too. But these are important to have that in your framework, because you can say love God. Oh, I love God. Everybody loves God. But what does it mean to love God with all your heart, with all your soul, and all your strength? Kind of a recap in what we looked at today. Simply heart, emotions. Soul, life or death. And strength, your stuff. Your stuff. The things that you can control. Because strength, well, what is your strength? What strength do you have under your control? Yes, David.
So, the way I understand it, the 1,050 New Testament laws help define the 613 Old Testament laws, which helps define the Ten Commandments, which hang on the two pillars of love your God and love your neighbor.
Yes. So when we talk about intent, the intent of Mishpatim, everything we're looking at today, the intent of everything else you'll see within the Torah, within the law, you know, the prophets, the writings, and then within the apostolic writings as well, should all be stemming from that. So if we get into a case like we were brought up here initially with the slave and, you know, knocking out eyes and gouging out, or knocking out teeth and gouging out eyes, well, there has to be something related to love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. So there we have to start with those two things. Is this what it means to love God wholly? Is this what you would want to have done to you? To have your eye gouged out and your teeth knocked out, at the very least, that are mentioned explicitly. So those are the things we have to start with. If these are, you could say, noise words, then they would be veering off from those two key things. We're going to get in our kind of second part of this into, you could say, the second Haftarah of this, which is really, it was kind of touched on today. Thank you for that in Matthew chapter 5, because Matthew chapter 5 is really a good one to pair together with this section. Yes?
Would the servant have the right to call for a judge to help him if he was beat? Because you're talking about judgments, and then I started to think, then you were talking about the 70 judges and then the 10 judges, and I thought, they have to bring the matters before the judges, but would the servant be allowed to do that?
Well, there's the types of servants, but then it also talks about widows and orphans, and it mentions specifically orphans, and then what does it mention about orphans? If they cry out to me and I hear it. Yes. So you're talking about things that you could say, even down to those, the widows and orphans, which in ancient societies and sadly even today, widows and orphans can be neglected, forgotten, cast to the side, even when they are among the most vulnerable in society, then as in now. So even to those you would see as the least important, their claims, which you would think may not rise to the top, will rise to the top. So, kind of starting back with the questions and drilling down even deeper into this, it starts out with this phrase where we get the title of this, you know, these are the Mishpatim. And this is kind of the phrase that starts the section that runs all the way through the end there, talking about this is the book of the covenant. This is the book of the covenant. So you got this section that runs through then into chapter 24, this is the book of the covenant. That's, and what is the covenant? What is the thing that was cut, the deal that was cut that you see them agreeing to at the latter part of the section? Everything you said, we will do it. We're going to do all this stuff. So, this is kind of a collection of things that are talked about. You know, the Mishpatayv, now the Mitzvatayv, Mishpatayv, the Chukatayv, his commandments, his ordinances, and his instructions. Now, they're all considered together. Well, are they all the same? This section here, what we're talking about, is talking about specifically the Mishpatim. So we'll drill down a little bit more into Mishpatim to see what this is referring to. A couple of things that we would have with the word Mishpat is translated various ways of judgment, decision by arbitration, legal specifications, legal case, legal claim. That's how you get out of one lexicon. Stemming from the verb, as Hebrew words tend to do. To judge. Shafat. To judge. So, from that sense, one of the things that we get as you trace this through all couple hundred uses of this particular word, mishpat, throughout the whole Tanakh, the Torah, the writings, and the prophets, one of the things that you'll get is that this is referring to government, kind of in a broad sense. Government, how you operate, how you order a society. But then you go into a more specific use of mishpat, and you see, like, people, at least 13 different categories of how this is used throughout the word. And one of the core things that you see in there is that this is referring to justice. And what is justice? It comes from the word just, which means what? Right. The things that are correct. So something is correct, something is incorrect. Something is good, something is bad. Goes all the way back to the garden. The tree of the knowledge of good and bad. The knowledge of the things that are good, knowledge of the things that are bad. So we're looking at things that are right versus the things that are not right. And given that this is flowing out of the Ten Commandments, the Ten Words, these are, you could say, statements of what is right behavior, right governance, right action. That is a little bit of a testimony of who the Lord is. So, just a look of running through some of these examples of it. Kind of a section of meanings you might have is judicial. Kind of bucket of meanings. Judicial. First one of which, the act of deciding a case of litigation brought before a civil magistrate. This is a case that's brought. So you're talking earlier, well, who's going to bring this case? An aggrieved party. You know, today we have the buckets of the civil and the criminal. Civil cases tend to be between two parties. Two, you could say, separate parties. And criminal cases often are between your governing authority and the, you could say, the perpetrator. So that's why we call it like the people versus blah, 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 the people versus blah, blah, blah. So you have some governing authority is bringing this against somebody else. So we divide them up into civil and the criminal. Here, you could say in a sense, you're dealing also with the civil and the criminal. Because one of the things we talked about, the widows and the orphans, in which case that you were to do something bad against a widow or an orphan, that would be the kingdom of God versus blah, 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 you know, so-and-so who did something to a widow or an orphan. That's what that aggrieved case would be. So when you trace these through, you'll see that, especially in the prophets, this case brought against them is the case that the Lord is bringing. Another one is actually the place where you're deciding this. And it's the building of a hall of justice. We call them today halls of justice. Well, that idea originally came from, this is a place where you're going to bring and hear the cases. You'll see that eventually there in 1 Kings 7:7 came to an actual building. But you'll see even down in the times of the judges, and even in the section we're looking at today, that they were bringing the cases to the person who was going to be making the decisions. Mentioned Moshe, and then when Moshe was up in the cloud, what did he say? Who's going to be making the decisions in his absence? Yes, Aharon and Hur, in his absence, were going to be making those decisions. And you see that delegated out in the previous section to, Yitro says, hey, you know, you've got to have a system where this delegated authority goes down from higher levels down to lower levels. So, thus, you've got two levels of this. And you see that mentioned in this particular passage. What are those two levels? The people that you do not curse. To give you a hint. What does this section say about people you do not curse? Don't curse your mother and your father, okay? Then what does it also say? Don't curse God. But we'll kind of get to that expansion of what that's referring to. And don't curse the leader of your people. So one of those things there about the curse. Curse is actually referring to make little, to lower the stature of. So you think, oh, curse, you're just going to, you know, spout out some obscenity or, you know, I wish you will die or something like that. But the greater sense of that, just like with the sense of, you know, taking the Lord's name in vain, is more than just saying a particular name of the Lord. It is to make, in that case, a vain, to make it nothing, to make it lower. In this case, curse is to make lower, to make the stature of your parents lower. Starting where? Starting with the person, the perp first, but then also expanding out beyond the perp to anyone else who's witnessing this. So you see later on, they're talking about bringing a false charge, all that such. Yeah, that goes into that bucket as well. So why is it then important to have that, you could say, respect put at the top? Parents, God, and the leader of the people. Why is that important there at the top? Respectful of authority. And one of the things that we'll also kind of get as we move on here about another layer of the judicial meaning of this word, mishpat, the process of litigation. So things actually have a process, which gets to our overarching question, is this vigilantism? The usage of mishpat throughout the word is about a process. You have aggrieved parties, somebody's angry at such and such, or you have a crime, has to be dealt with. There's a process that it goes through. Bringing it on further, you know, we talked about that, a case of litigation, then a sentence or a decision. So we think, oh, well, okay, this fits in what we think of judgments. Someone is bringing down a curse, a sentence or a judgment that's coming from a court, and also time of judgment. And mishpat is seen in, see there in Psalm 1 and also in Ecclesiastes 12, you get this picture of it expanding further into a time of judgment that things will be made right. We call that generally what? The day of the Lord. Day of the Lord, mentioned down in the prophets, is a time where what was wrong will be made right. Lies will be done away with. Lies will be replaced with truth. Death will be replaced with life. So what was good will replace the things that are bad. So going back to, you say, the garden where you have the knowledge of good and bad, hopefully over this whole span of time in Earth's history, we will learn that the bad way is a really bad way to go. I know it's kind of a circular definition there, but yes, we will learn that bad actually is bad. Sadly, it takes so long to get to that, but one of those things that we learn as we go through, like a section like Mishpatim, and as we get into the rest of Exodus, and then into Leviticus, and then Deuteronomy, we will see what it truly means to go bad. And it also kind of helps explain, when you get into the historical writings, why Israel's history did go bad. And then it went good, then it went bad, and then it went good, and it went bad. Was that just kind of random? It just Some days they got on the wrong side of the bed, the bad side of the bed, then they got on the good side of the bed, then the bad side of the bed, then the good side of the bed. What was happening? Forgetting where they came from. You know, treating people terribly. You see a lot of the prophets, especially, you know, Yeshayahu or Isaiah, just talks about that a lot. Forgetting where you come from. Forgetting that, hey, you were a slave too. You were in bondage in Mitzrayim. That's also one of the things that's mentioned in this particular passage. Why do you not treat those servants poorly? Because you were once a servant. You were once in that same situation. So, going back to that, love your neighbor as yourself, as you love yourself, treat other people the way you want to be treated, goes back to that idea. Do you remember being in a similar situation where it was really a bad case? So, kind of moving on into a little point here, which you get really at the beginning part of Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy 1:17, where you got this warning to Israel's judges not to show partiality in judgment or in executing their office. They are acting on God's behalf. As it mentions there in Zechariah 7 and 8, that judgment belongs to God. And you see later on in Israel's history where Absalom circumvented that, where he was actually sitting there at the gate and his people were coming in to go to justice, the Hall of Justice, as it became known later. He was saying, oh, hey, you have a case? Ah, come over here. You don't need to go over there. Come over here. I'll settle your case for you. So, it gets back to that whole thing. Do not curse God. Do not curse the leader of your people, Absalom, who led down a huge diversion in Israel's history down the wrong road, was circumventing around where the authority was put. Absalom thought that the way that the leadership was going, not the way he wanted it to go. So he wanted to go take it a different route. One of the things that you'll see also, and it gets down to what we see, it's the ending part of Mishpatim where it talks about the 7 years that you're having your plantings, and in the seventh year, you stop your plantings. We'll see that later as we get into Numbers, where it refers to the Shemitah and the Shemitah year and everything that that entails. But one of the things that we see here is that they failed to do that. Failed to do that as you actually look in history. It's spelled out in all kinds of detail about the Shemitah year and the Jubilee year. This is the way that you're going to let your servants go. People were working for you, but they didn't want to do it. They just wanted to keep it going. And when you're talking about, well, with the Haftarah there, why is this emphasized? Why was the Shemitah emphasized? And why was it then later on where they realized, wow, we really blew it? You need to give your servants rest. What is an interesting thing, we talk about, you know, the different reasons that are given for the Shabbat, the weekly Shabbat. So every seventh day, you have a time where you stop. What do we see there in Exodus chapter 20 for that reason to stop? Because, yes, because the Lord stopped. Because the Lord stopped, thus you stop. Now, you see an extra layer added on top of this. Well, you stop, and it's even mentioned there in Exodus 20 as well, that you let your servants stop. Those people that are with, as it says, within your gates. You know, one of the things that we should always be careful of is defining our gates too narrowly. Because what is it when it says within your gates? People you do business with, within your, we call it The big old loaded term for that, sphere of influence. So you think of it just like in the example of a city. A city in ancient times, the fortified cities would have a wall. Even some smaller ones would have even a stockade or some sort of barrier to the outside because of those ne'er-do-wells who never do well, and they come in, and it's actually touched in a little bit on this section about thieves when they come into your house. But you have the barriers out there to keep those who will not stay on their side of the barrier on the other side of the barrier. You keep them over on that side. So thus, we would say, the boundaries, the things that we have control over. Because one of the ancient things that people learn quite easily is that you do not extend your boundaries and your walls beyond that which you can actually control. Because if you extend your boundaries out too far, what happens? Invasion. You cannot defend it all. You overreach. You overreach in your grasp and the things that you are taking responsibility over. We're going to get to that a little bit in what you see in the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew chapter 5 through 7. It was one of the things, you'll even see it there in Mark chapter 7, the issue of washing your hands. What is one of the things that you might say is a key thing that's underlying a lot of Yeshua's fights, you could say, against the scribes, Pharisees, those that he was fighting with? Not all scribes, not all Pharisees, but the ones that he was actually contending with. What was one of the key issues and the matters of that underlying those?
They were doing things from a legal standpoint, but there was no heart in it, and they were not doing it to honor God. It was just a very legalistic thing that they were doing without real concern for the people or what they were doing.
Yeah, as he talks about, you know, you create burdens that you do not even lift, even with but a finger to lift the burdens off of people. So in a sense, you are then, they were extending their boundaries, calling them God's boundaries, to encompass people and rope them inside of it, bringing them their authority in beyond it. So that is one of those things where we talk about with hypocrisy also. Hypocrisy is saying one thing, doing another. But then you compound it by not only saying one thing and doing another, but then telling other people that they must do that as well. It's one of the issues there in Mark chapter 7 with washing your hands. A custom, a good custom, it derives, as we'll get further into Leviticus, derives back from the what was happening in the tabernacle. That's, we see that in Psalm 24, where you come before the Lord with clean hands and a righteous heart. Well, that's a good thing in practice. But then if you say that is what the Lord actually commands, that's where the problem came in, as you see it recorded in Mark chapter 7. So what did Yeshua say? You are teaching for doctrine. You are teaching for mishpatim, for mitzvot, for the hokim. What? Commandments of men, or traditions of men, traditions of the elders. Maybe good, a good practice, a good, you know, call them spiritual disciplines, something to keep you going down the right path. But saying that, hey, God is actually commanding it. We have to be careful about extending our walls, our gates out into other people's gates and trying to fence them into our fences. Yes?
Right then. That would be cursing God's name. Is that correct?
So how do you see the connection there?
You took God. You said this was
making God's name of no effect, or exactly. Or you know, to make it vain.
Right.
So by saying, "Hey, God is saying this," yet He really didn't say that. So remember that these are called the tablets of the testimony. So by you saying God tells you to do this, what are you doing? You are testifying that this is what the Lord is like. But is the Lord really like that? No. Maybe headed toward it if it's done in the right manner with the right heart. But is it really saying, oh, you actually must do this, that this is an absolute testimony? That's where the problem comes in. And that's also kind of a key to understanding what Paul was getting at. Was Paul, and actually Yeshayahu or Isaiah, especially chapter 1 there, was he actually speaking against the things of God? Or how the things of God were being used? Or I should say, abused. And this, specifically, some of those prophets were actually talking about what was happening in the northern kingdom, which was, they had a totally different set of all the holy days and everything like that. So when you're talking about, I hate your face, you know, you have to be, also be careful of the context, because those were taking the people in a completely different direction. Saying about testifying who God was, well, they were in a completely different direction where they were testifying that actually, and you see that archaeologically, they had married, literally, the Lord and the fertility god by all kinds of different names. Yes, actually, a comment over here, yes.
I was just wondering if it's the same thing to, like, be angry at God is the same thing as cursing him, or, I mean, are we allowed to, like, feel that way sometimes, or if I, you know.
Are we allowed to what?
If we feel angry towards God sometimes. Ah. Have any of us ever felt that way? Like, is that the same as cursing him?
Well, where are those examples that you see in the Word? Yonah? Okay. There are examples in the Word of people getting angry, or you could say maybe pushing hard. I think one of the key things that I always have to remember in that was with Abraham right there, Sodom and Gomorrah, actually challenging and saying, are you a God of justice or not? Really? Are you a God of justice or not? And you would think, wow, that's pretty strong. But what is it? What is it that was actually changing? God's answer was changing in response to it. What about with, you know, about Yonah and Nineveh? The city was going to be overthrown. The city will be overthrown. The city will be overthrown. Yet then it talks about that the people repented, sadly, far better than the people of Israel were. They repented truly to the point where the Lord said, okay, no, I'm not going to overthrow.
But
yes.
Wasn't part of Jonah's problem that he knew God was merciful and he might actually forgive them, and that was why he rebelled against God, because he didn't want those people forgiven?
That is it's a very interesting thing, because you see that even mentioned in there in his, you could say his, I don't know, you call it whining, maybe would be a way to put it. Yeah, I know that you are a merciful one who would forgive. Huh. I know that you are a merciful one who would forgive. What was it, when you're talking about the testimony of God, you could say the full name of God that was expressed to Moshe? Slow to anger, merciful, and listed a whole long list of other attributes. Those are what you're saying is the testimony of what God is like. So the things that we see here in this section, Mishpatim, should be reflecting that. If this is what the Lord is actually communicating, then this is what we should see in what these things are being communicated in this. So, judges should judge justly, which gets us back to who was this section directed at? One of the things that you see several times in this section, and I see it in Exodus 22, specifically verses 8 and 9, but you see it in several times throughout this section, Who was this thing? Where were they supposed to be bringing these cases? It says, in this particular, this is New American Standard, they translated it two different ways. And you might say, both could be okay. It says, bring them to God. Bring them Ha Elohim. Or, it's also translated, bring them to the judges. What is it that, kind of a weird thing that's been taken in a completely strange direction by one particular religious group is a section that's Yeshua quoted from the Psalms. And he says, haven't you read? It says, you are, one way you could translate it is, you are gods. You are Elohim. And you are, because one of the things that we can, you see it translated, Elohim, gods. Because strictly back to El, whether you're talking about Hebrew or Akkadian, Ugartic, or various other Semitic languages, El is a common term. And it means powerful one, the strong one, the powerful one. So, powerful ones here. And that's a very interesting testimony that we have of the Creator, is that's one way that He is described as Elohim. Also, you know, described in the singular, but Elohim is also a term that is used for the Lord in this case. But also something that's directed for people who are making decisions. And later on in Exodus, you see where is this judgment? Where are these mishpatim directed to? The priesthood. The priesthood, those become the ones. Here, you talk about the amazing responsibility that's put upon these people. Because you got not only the leaders of tens, the 50s, the hundreds, the thousands, all the way up. Then you also have the priesthood beyond that. And then you see later up, you've got Moshe. Layer upon layer of this authority going up to make these decisions. So thus, one of these things that you could always look at this is that Mishpatim is directed toward community. Because you could say government, justice, right sort of actions are directed toward a community. So addressing one of our questions at the outset, is this vigilantism? No. If you're talking about community justice, this is not vigilantism because it has to, the justice, the right action and the correction of bad action has to be done what? In the context of a community. In the context of a community. Yes?
I'm wondering, when, just to go back just a little bit here, when we're talking about, you're talking about, there's a quote in Psalms about you are gods.
Yes.
Well, Messiah quoted that.
Yes.
And if that's incorrect, what was he? I always felt he said you're powerful.
Yes.
But did he quote it? No. Incorrect?
No, absolutely correct. And that is a very interesting way that Elohim is used as a way to describe judges. Because what is one of the things, and it's mentioned a few times here at the outset of this passage, what do these Elohim over these particular Mishpatim have authority over? Life and death. We mentioned a few times here in this passage where there is what we call capital punishment involved. One involving strangling, one involving, you could say, other unpleasant ways to go, but power over life and death. That this is something that happens within a community is making this determination. It's delegated to someone to do this. Yes.
Regards to the comment, yeah, you're right, the quote to the Psalms, keep in mind that when we're discussing the Torah and discuss these details about how laws are supposed to be applied in judges, it is not just assumed, it is required. The judge himself is at one with God. if you are not at one with God, you're not a good judge. Get rid of you, replace you. Hence, all the kings were supposed to be at one with God. You were as if one and the same. So a judge or a king or Messiah or any man who is righteous man is supposed to be at one with God. They are a God, meaning not God, the creator of making things, but they are at one with him. Yeah, the small t.
Yeah.
They're attached to him, and he is part of him is inside of them, and they are at one with him. So yes, in a manner of speaking, he's completely correct. You are gods, meaning you are following, and you are at one with the one who's guiding you and making you and giving you what is good judgment.
The same with walking with God. Yeah, righteous people must walk with God. So thus, your judges have to be ones who are close to God. They have to, be ambassadors. Ambassadors, not just, you could say ambassadors representing a one nation to a foreign nation, but this is talking about within one particular community that these Elohim are making decisions, life and death and property, making decisions of that. And what are those things related to theft? We'll be getting to that eventually. If you can't pay your restitution, then what? You get sold. A strange foreign concept in our modern society. But, we have our, own forms of servitude, indentured servitude, and we call them student loans. Those things that you can't get rid of, even in bankruptcy. But, you'd say it's almost getting to the point of having that. And boy, if you don't pay those things up and they start coming after you, you almost wish you could sell yourself to get out of that because they start attaching everything. Yeah, you wish you'd have a Shemitah where you have a discharging of debts. Sadly, those student loans, they don't discharge that one. But with that one, you've got life, death, and your property and, your ability to do what you want to do. Because even today, if a court attaches your wages, you can't do what you want to do. You have to then pay. It's like you have a giant vacuum cleaner in your wallet now. And it's just sucking it all out. You have no control over that part that it's siphoning off. So, when you talk about authority, we're talking about sovereignty. That these Mishpatim are talking about who is actually sovereign. Is it whatever you want to do? Or is it the Lord that is saying, hey, this is the way the world works, and then passing things down that, okay, I'm the creator, I'm the redeemer, listen to me. If you don't listen to me, you're going to start seeing where things are going to go wrong very fast. Kind of another bucket of these Mishpatim, or you could say the Mishpat throughout Scripture, is in the legislative area, where you're talking about justice for all kinds of administration of the government. And one of the things you see here, and it's mentioned here specifically in Psalm 36 and 37, is about justice is an attribute of God. It's a testimony that, just like we were talking with Abraham, that the Lord will act justly. So you could say by extension that these Mishpatim that we're reading about here today will be just. One of those things that we were kind of looking at in the beginning, is one particular aspect of it. Correction, other way you can say terrible beatings of a servant. Is that just or not? And we're keep moving toward our exploration of that. Yes.
Question. So would another picture of just would also be like his promises when Yeshua says, who the Father has given to me, no one can snatch them out of my hand. So that's being just, right?
Especially when you combine that with his parable of various ways it's described, but basically the hired hands And the ones who were hired at the, quote, 11th hour, basically the last hour of the day, the last hour of the workday, and they were paid the same as everybody else. The ones that had been there the whole time were griping. Hey, what are you talking about? This is not right. I've been here slaving away, you know, working in the kingdom of God, doing all the stuff. I've been a good boy, not a bad boy. And I get the same thing as everyone else. So it's one of those things that's just like with, you'd say, like the parable of the lost son. Should be a party. Hey, this guy came in at 4 o'clock and he's getting full pay for the day. Yeehaw. Well, what a merciful employer we have. So, in a sense, also looking at this, we should be as merciful as the Lord is merciful. So when we're talking about love the Lord with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength, love your neighbor, you know, as yourself, as you would love yourself, that should be a part of it as well, to be as merciful as the Lord is merciful. You could say, repay in a disproportionate manner than what you were doled out against. Which sort of gets us back into touching a little bit on that eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth matter. Marching a little bit closer to that. Because that is the one thing. You'll hear it in music. You'll hear it in stories. People just quote eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. Eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. Eye for an eye. That has become a testimony of the world about the Lord. Like it or not, that is a testimony that the world has about the Lord. Eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. So, marching closer to, I don't think that means what you think it means. Yes. But one of those things that we'll see, that justice is also an important attribute of the Mashiach. Here in a passage from Psalm 72, kind of the beginning part of it. Give the king your judgments, O God, and your righteousness to the king's son, that may he judge your people with righteousness and your afflicted with justice. As it gets reflected on through sages and such, you've got king, in this case, talking about the king of Israel. But then you see also expanded out further to the great king of Israel in Mashiach, that this king's son would be delegated, judge your people with righteousness. Shafat, your people with righteousness, and your afflicted with mishpat. So, with justice, do we want ourselves to be ruled with an iron hand? Let's talk about the iron fist. We see that it talks about that the rule with the iron hand is coming. It's mentioned in Revelation that the Son of Man is going to be coming, and he will rule the nations with what? Oh, an iron rod. Oh, I don't want that one. That kind of sounds like what we were talking about, the eye for an eye and losing eyes and teeth and everything else. That doesn't sound good at all. It takes it to a whole new level. But one of those things that you see in the midst of that, and you see in the first opening chapters of Revelation, is what? To the one who overcomes. To the one who overcomes. The right to eat the tree, the crown of life, and on it goes. Not to, well, you're going to get the iron rod a little bit less on you. No. The iron rod is not coming your way. You are, and you could say, saved from the iron rod. Saved from the iron rod. So, as we kind of close out our discussion with this, one of those things that this comment here from a passage on Old Testament theology mentions that when therefore the scripture speaks of mishpats of God, as it frequently does, the word has a particular shade of meaning, and that is not so much just statutes of God, but just as the just claims of God. God, who is the Lord, can demand, and he does demand. So, one of those cases, there, you could say, a lot of demanding aspects of God. But What is it? What is it actually taking us toward? It's back to that. These two judgments, you could call them, commands in this passage of Mishpatim. Do not curse your father, your mother. Do not curse, do not break down God. Ooh, an interesting thing you could say, almost the Elohim as well, the judges and the leader of your people. Paul, in Acts, he ran headlong into that himself. As he was brought in before the Sanhedrin of the time period, and he had some harsh words for the leader of the assembly, only to find out that that was the person who was designated to be the high priest that year. Well, that is a great lesson for what it means about do not curse, do not talk down, do not belittle the leader of the people or the Elohim, the judges. Because, you know, in history, we know what those high priests were like. And in the Gospels, they talk about what those high priests were like. Good people? Some? They were also people who were appointed by Rome. You say it might come with a recommend, but they got the stamp of Rome upon them. These were political offices. Yeah, not the line even originally from the reestablishment of the temple during the time of the Maccabees. Eventually, that got devolved down. So, what you're dealing with in Paul's case was a bad guy who was in a role of the high priest. He was the leader of the people. Yet, Paul rightly said, wow, even though this guy is a so-and-so, I shouldn't be saying so-and-so, and I shouldn't be making other people think so-and-so of this particular guy. And he repented before an unrighteous man that, hey, because what was his real crime against? The so-and-so? The office, you could say, the office, but also the authority that the Lord had put in place. And that's one of those things that we can also say in this passage there about do not talk down, belittle the stature or the authority of the father and the mother. Is that, yeah, we can have a lot of disagreements with our parents. We don't think, and it's amazing how little they know during their teenage years. Yeah, their wisdom just takes a nosedive during those teenage years. And amazingly, it's like they pull it out. They're almost running into the ground right around age 20. Well, these days it's almost 30 and sometimes even 40. But they amazingly get more wise as time goes on. When we actually live a little bit and get to see what is actually involved with leading children. So, well, what goes around comes around. We get to see it a little bit ourselves. But the importance of it is the position of these people in authority. You know, today we have an incredible barrage that's going against people in authority. An incredible barrage against people in authority. We can say, well, they're so-and-sos, Well, what then happens because of it? Even in secular societies, in Confucian society, they even said that parents and the leaders are the bedrock of the society. You knock them down, the whole society goes down with them. And what do we see? We see that even today. You knock down the parents, the family falls apart. Family falls apart, what happens? The community falls apart. Community falls apart, what happens to your judges? Your judges have any idea what direction they should be going in? And it goes down and down and down. And when we talk about those things in Mishpatim and even back into with the 10 words, you know, remember the Shabbat? Well, if there's no one to teach the next generation what to remember and why they should remember it, will it actually be remembered? And as in Deuteronomy talks about, guarded, will these things be remembered and guarded? No. And will even the future generations know why it's beneficial to remember and to guard? No. Dietrich Bonhoeffer belittling the Nazi Party. Yeah, and that was an interesting thing where you had these people that were, you know, he and his group, they're talking against the regime at the time period, pointing them out in pretty strong words. Now, it's one of those things that you can use Paul's example with that. Do you point out where the things are going astray? Or do you say that the person is a so-and-so? Yeshua, what did Yeshua say in this sense? You know, about cursing people. About, if you say, you fool, you're in danger of, you know, the burning junk pile outside. That was known as Gehenna. Or the Valley of Hinnom. The garbage, stinking dump that was on fire and smoldering. So, one of those pictures of you fool versus just saying that you're headed astray is you fool, as you see it mentioned like in Proverbs, and it says the fool does this and it's folly to do that. We throw around fool and folly just willy-nilly, but one of the things that you'll see, I mean, kind of a good little word search to go on, what is the context of how fool and folly is actually used throughout the word? And what you'll see is a connection between wisdom, you say wisdom and folly. Well, even in English, we have those ranges of meaning between a spectrum between wisdom and folly. Well, wisdom heads in a certain direction. Folly heads in what? The opposite direction. And you see in the first few chapters of Proverbs, you see the personification of wisdom. And wisdom leading in one direction. And then you see folly heading in another direction, away from God. So one of the things where you see fool used is a person who is headed away from God. Now, the deacon Stephen could have said, hey, this guy Paul, he's headed to Gehenna. And this guy is just a son of hell. Son of hell. He's going down. He's going up in flames, going down in a burning ring of fire. He is. Because what was Stephen's last vision of Paul? There, supervising his execution for a completely trumped up charge. And even, you know, securing a death sentence against the believers in Yeshua in various other cities. Going around there, not just okay to deal with it in his own city, but headed to other cities to round people up and to bring them back in chains. In Stephen's case, have him executed. But this is kind of a good thing that you just can never see the end of people. Even if we think we see the end of people, we just do not know. So when we see judgment belongs to God, but then God also delegates judgment down to the Elohim below, the powerful ones that are over us, the judges that are over us. So thus, when it says, when Yeshua said, do not judge because you will be judged. I'm not saying that there's never any judgment out there, because there is plenty. I mean, Mishpatim, we got a whole book of instructions about this is the right way to behave, this is the wrong way to behave. But wow, that authority that sits on your head of life and death, and, you know, let's say your personal property, this or that, a lot of things can go in on the responsibility of being a judge, of being Ha Elohim. Don't take that on. Don't take that on. If it's delegated to, then, you know, praise God. But wow, don't step up to be one. Because look at what the consequences are of that. I mean, you think of, as we go through this, and we'll be delving further into some of the details in our next section, but wow, look at what the responsibility they have in making some of these decisions, especially the ones that involve life and death. And you see in the latter part about the injunction against the judges about bribes, false witnesses, stuff like that. Wow, what if you make a mistake? It's one of the things that's a argument against capital punishment today. Well, what if we make a mistake? Yeah, what if you make a mistake? What if you do make a mistake? So, good lesson for that. Don't strive to be a judge. So when the Messiah says, judge not lest ye be judged, don't step into the role of a judge. Unless you truly want someone to step into the role of a judge against you. Not that there is no other standards, that God has lowered standards, just that, wow, he has standards, but just be careful about saying, expanding your gates to include somebody else, and then saying, okay, now you're under my jurisdiction. So look out. Before we get into some of the details, we're going to take another kind of look under the hood of what some of these Mishpatim are referring to. And another good perspective to get before we launch into it further is some of the beginning part of Matthew chapter 5, which launches into the Sermon on the Mount, as it's called, that stretches between Matthew chapter 5 and Matthew chapter 7. So we're going to begin here with verse 3 of Matthew chapter 5. And we have a good thing to note, often called the Beatitudes, but the word that's often translated blessed is kind of akin to what you see in the Psalms referring to, you could say, happy are you, prosperous are you. So that's when it talks about blessed, not just this kind of ethereal blessing. You might, oh, what does that actually mean? It means that you are actually happy. You are actually being filled up because of this. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. Blessed are the gentle, for they will inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be satisfied. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall receive mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God. Blessed are those who have persecuted, who have been persecuted for the sake of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when people insult you and persecute you, and falsely say all kinds of evil against you because of me. Rejoice and be glad, for your reward in heaven is great. For in the same way they persecuted the prophets who were before you. You are the salt of the earth, but if the salt has become tasteless, how can it be made salty again? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled underfoot by men. You are the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden, nor does anyone light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on the lampstand, and it gives light to all those who are in the house. Let your light shine before men in such a way that they may see your good works and glorify your Father who is in heaven. Do not think that I came to abolish the law and the prophets. I did not come to abolish, but to fulfill. For truly I say to you, until heaven and earth pass away, not the smallest letter or stroke shall pass from the law until all is accomplished. Whoever then annuls one of the least of these commandments and teaches others to do the same, shall be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever keeps them and teaches them shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven. For I say to you that unless your righteousness surpasses that of the scribes and Pharisees, you will not enter the kingdom of heaven. So there he goes. You get another good backdrop. So you put that together with, you say, the two great commandments. You know, love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength. Love your neighbor as yourself. Combine that with these things, the attributes, the blessed are you, the happy are you, things that the Messiah said. That those who mourn, for they will be comforted. Those who are poor in spirit. The gentle. Hunger and thirst for righteousness. Merciful. Pure in heart. Peacemakers. And also, you see down there where it talks about the parables of salt and light. That these are meant to be a blessing. Attributes of the people of God that will make the kingdom of God be something that actually preserves and actually directs the whole world out of darkness. So that's when we look back and we start looking at these Mishpatim, we should be seeing these attributes. We should be seeing these things we see in the Beatitudes. And then you see the closing statement there in Matthew chapter 5, verse 20. That our righteousness has to exceed that of the scribes and the Pharisees. Because you could say, what is the source text of the scribes and the Pharisees? Well, we think the scribes, what? It's kind of in the job description there. What do? They copy the words of God. And, you know, part of that was also teaching the words of God. So they have to actually know the words of God. So you would say, okay, well, hypocrisy in there, and you read throughout the Gospels about hypocrisy, but the righteousness has to be beyond that, and something that Paul kind of touches on, that gets taken off in a different direction, where it says that there is a righteousness above the Torah, above the law. What is that righteousness that's above the Torah? God himself. God himself is above that. So, thus, if you are truly loving the Lord, your God, with all your heart, soul, and strength, loving your neighbor as yourself, that is right behavior that's floating above the words. So, thus, the scribes and the Pharisees, they have the words. But what was the problem? Didn't have the heart. Their heart, their soul, their strength was stuck in the words. You might even say below the words, below the actual words that were on the page. So when you talk about making the Torah stand up, making it fall down, by not even living up to the words of the Torah, they were making the teachings from the Torah fall down, especially because of their behavior. They were not salt. They were not preserving the world, purifying it. They were not lighting the way. They were creating more darkness, even though their source text was the same. Yes?
Interesting to note that their archaeologists have uncovered over 20 different sects of Pharisees.
Yep. And a whole lot of them.
And one of the sects was actually called the hypocrites. So it was not unusual for Messiah to, because he identified with the Pharisees, it wasn't uncommon for two different sects of Pharisees to be arguing.
Oh,
just
yeah.
Just like Hillel and Shammai.
Yes, they were definitely, you could say, had heated words for each other. And, when you talk about brood of vipers and such like that, that was in some common terminology that they would send back and forth to each other. So the point is that what are you actually prodding people on? If you're, you know, what you see there in Matthew, when You see the Messiah talking about, you know, whitewashed tombs, an empty grave, a brood of vipers. Is the point to just tear down or to tear down and to build up? Because as you see later on, that there were Pharisees that were among the, it talks about in Acts, Paul himself, say with a very strong conversion, or you could say a turnaround repentance story that he had, but he indeed turned around with that. The sect of the way would be, a, I guess you could say, a branch of it. Because, you know, as you look at it, there's probably only in one case where you have a significant congruence between the teachings of Yeshua and the what you would say with the school of Shammai. But those indeed were more like in the Pharisees' camp. When we delve into some of the details that we're getting at here in Exodus 21, we see laws of slaves that kind of stretch for the first 11 verses of Hebrews 21, kind of divided up into the laws for the male slave in the general, and then ones for the female slave in general. So, starting out first here, questions related to this. Just so that we're kind of on to the, when we bring our questions forward, that we're kind of staying within this realm, in this passage here of Exodus 21. Yeah, what questions do you have bringing forward with this? Because I have one for you. Exodus 21, starting in this first part here. Because I have one for you. What is the relevance of the passage where it talks about, and you were slaves in Egypt? What does that bear into? Especially with what we just read in the Beatitudes in Matthew chapter 5. The way you treat strangers has to do with the way you treat strangers. Don't want to be guilty of doing the same thing as they were treated there in Egypt. Okay, so that is you're now, when you say love your neighbor as yourself, thus the way you would treat your servant should be the way you would want to be treated. And especially with the hook back to, because you were servants there in Egypt. So thus we have a hook. To say, the things that we're going to be seeing here related to slaves is, hey, you don't want to be treating your servants any worse than you were treated. Especially when we start looking at the context of these particular believers. So, yes, a question over here.
If I was a slave, I would want to be a slave.
You want to be a slave to a righteous former slave.
I was going to be a slave.
Yes.
I would want to be a slave to a righteous former slave. Mm. Because that slave is going to know what slavery truly is. And he's going to be able to reflect and understand that of being a slave. So who's going to give you the most just rewards and understanding of a slave? Who's going to take care of their slave better than somebody that used to be a slave? So in your question that you asked, I would think that when he makes mention that, don't forget you were once a slave, think about how you were treated. Think about how you cried out. Think about how your back was broken. Think about how you wanted a day of rest. You know, think about that when you think about your slave.
Hmm. Okay. So getting a little bit closer to seeing what you could say the heart of the matter is. So, if you indeed were put in the realm of being a judge, and these matters were brought to you over what? Someone that would be going into slavery because their debts, or because you had a servant and his case was being brought forward. One of the key contexts of that is how do you remember your treatment? What treatment would you like to have. So thus, moving on into one of the more problematic ones, we say archaic and obsolete, and that's related to the female servant. And we say, well, my goodness, this the text in there referring to a father selling daughter. This is what is specifically mentioned in this part. I mean, it just seems like so unbelievably strange to us today about this. One of the things that you see in there is related to how you treat her. What are the, you would say, in the context of how this person was to be treated, do you just treat her like anyone else? No? What does it specifically say? And if this is something that you don't, if the reason for her coming to your family is not something you would say that's going to work out, it's mentioned there is, you know, find a reason that you don't like her to be a part in there, you allow her to be redeemed. That's a very interesting point. And you see that, you know, later on, and it's some of the little backstory back and forth between, you say, in Ruth's life as well, that it was a very interesting wrangle between, you know, Boaz and her relative. But it gives you an interesting picture of, look at people who are in a difficult situation. Do you make it worse or do you make it better? We think in the general term of servants today. We may not have people who are indentured servants working off a debt or whatever. But what are the people who are, you could say, our servants? You know, may not be an incredibly close analogy, but what about an employer and employees? You say, well, okay, they're people for hire. They can come and go when they want, you know, and especially if you have states with, you know, right to work and, you know, freedom of movement and such. The relationship between employer and employee can be quite, you know, easy and fluid. But what does this say about the relationship between employers and employees? Yes.
So, you know, in those days compared to now, because you said, let's wind it back up to how does that apply to us today, is they knew what they were getting into, though, didn't they? As they were selling themselves to the Lord, they were clear of the law. They were clear of the commandments compared to now.
This may have been a judicial decision, though.
Right. I mean, when someone sold themselves, like today, people get into Christianity or into the relationship with the Lord, and they really don't clearly know what they're doing. You know, like Paul said, they take the blessing unwisely. So I think over this 20 years being in here, barely, I've, you know, barely even getting on the right way to even say, oh, wow, I never even thought that.
Yes. Oh.
Please correct me if I'm wrong, but most likely.
Correct.
So I think the thing that we have to keep in mind when we look at these things is we're not talking about the horrific slavery that went on in our early times in America. We're not talking about going and capturing people and beating them and dragging them to a foreign country and making them work like animals. We're talking about a system of a government and hierarchy in the sense that there is always going to be a lesser class. There is stages of people, and in that society, those people that were slaves, that term in slavery is nothing what our Western mind conceives. These people were, you know, they knew their duty. They weren't, you know, they didn't have the ability of flocks. They didn't have these things. So they were doing what they could to sustain a level of life that they were comfortable with, is if that makes sense.
Yeah, and what would then make you say that this was not the same situation as what we've in our country know of as the slavery that happened in the south part of the states and such?
Those people
they had no problem being a slave. They knew that that was their position. And yet, with inside that society, they were given multiple opportunities to go out and pick the last of the leftover fruits, to pick the last, you know, to get, they were allowed ways to come up and ways to get out of that situation if they no longer liked it, or if they could gain a higher authority or position within that. They weren't held down to that. They could buy themselves.
Yeah, and you also had the big restrictions upon the, you could say, the owner, the one who had the title to the person at that particular time. There was, let's say, a lot of restrictions upon the person. Because one of the things that you might note, and it seems quite strange when they talk about the, we would call it today, corporal punishment that it's mentioned in there, is that if in one case it talks about corporal punishment, but then in another case it says, well, if you do this, this, and this, and that, guess what? They go free. So what should that tell you? I mean, you put it in another context. It'd say, this Ferrari is yours. Just get in the Ferrari and have a great time. This is your Ferrari. But if you ding it, if you do this, if you do that, if you do this, and then on and on and on it goes, it ain't yours anymore. And then go on even further, if they were to say, well, then you had to have a bill, and it's really starting to eat into what is actually yours. What are you going to do with that Ferrari? Yeah. Treat it extremely carefully. You could say baby it and such. Because why? The alternative to not treating it well is very, very bad for you. Very, very bad for you. Because when you talk about selling yourself to somebody, what has the owner done? Paid for you. So the owner is already out. And then if he loses you too, he's out double. Because then he has to go acquire somebody else's debt to then get their contract. So thus, with so many restrictions upon the owner, then that should be telling you, hey, I should be extremely careful. I got to take care of it. Make care of it. So it's to the point where you see that, you know, the arrangements where you even have, you know, children, you know, provide a wife for your servant. And if they came in as a family, they're going out as a family. And to the point where if a servant says, hey, I like this contract, I'm just going to stay on and become basically a part of your family. Just become a part of your family. Because you see kind of an example of that with Eliezer earlier. Let's see. You think of Abraham. He's sending his, quote, slave off to do what? Find a wife, matchmaking for his son. So, I think this is the, you know, whipping boy. He was just out there just being beaten mercilessly, losing eyes, teeth, everything else, until finally the Torah came around to condemn him. No. This was someone who, you could say, was in a treasured position. Yes, you could say, interesting. Yes.
So you asked the question. Compare the owner in the days that the Brit Chadashah was, or Matthew,
yes,
he's talking about slave, and today between an employer, say. And I would say it's identical. And the reason for that is basically for many of the things that you said, but Matthew 7:12, it says, in everything, do unto others as you would have them to do unto you, period.
That's why you probably think this is unbelievably tedious. It's like, let's just dive into the details and start, you know, talking about archaeological digs and this and that and various inscriptions and whatnot. if we don't get what the overarching thing is, because we were talking earlier about the fact that these passages are arranged thematically, not necessarily chronologically, and you can start piecing them together where the chronology goes, but they're put in this particular arrangement for a particular reason, that this section is following after the Big Ten. So, should tell us that what the revelation of God was that went into the Big Ten is now getting revealed to us even more in this section. So that thus, when you see the Messiah is coming along and saying, hey, your righteousness has got to go beyond just the words on the page. There has to be a transformation inside of you that you want to be a peacemaker. You want to be someone who is, let's say, poor in spirit. You want to be, sadly, you want to be persecuted. And you might say, oh, that's terrible. That's terrible to be persecuted, especially when we read about the things that happen even today to our brothers and sisters in the spirit. But one of the things even that you can see in Acts, they rejoiced when they were persecuted. Why? Why does it say that they rejoiced when they were persecuted? Because they were suffering just a little bit because of the name. And because the Messiah suffered, they realized, wow, we are servants of the Master. The Master suffered, we suffered. And it's also a little bit of a witness, a testimony. Because we talk about martyrs. The root word of martyr in Greek is a witness. They are testifying to it. What is their testimony in the midst of their suffering, their persecution? Well, when we read about it, I know for me, I just say, wow, I'm quite the spiritual schlub. If there was, a whole group of armed people coming into my town and telling me, hey, you either start singing a completely different tune or you're going to be dead. Your whole family's going to be dead. Wow. Would I be willing to then have the mark of the Messiah on my door? Would I be out there trying to rub it off? Hopefully nobody saw it. Or would I actually be happy? Wow, somebody got the message that I am a servant of the Master. What people thought was for derision, by putting the Arabic noon on the side of their door or in their house, they said pure joy. Even to the point where they were like paraded out and publicly executed for the sake of the name. Yeah, it's happened here just in the past several years. No, not here in this country, in the Middle East. Some cases of Iraq and Syria. Yes, Bill.
What Dave was talking about for slaves, there were 7-year periods of release. The 50-year jubilee, everybody got released.
Yeah.
Debts, slaves went back to their parents and that, whatever. It was a lifetime. And they weren't treated like Dave was saying. It's a whole different kind of slavery than what went on in that country and other countries and here.
Yeah, it's a whole different kind of system. See, even to the point where you say, like, they didn't even want to go along with the system that they had later on in Israel's history of actually letting the debts be forgiven and letting the slaves go free until they saw the handwriting on the wall. Then they tried to repent for a little bit, and then it didn't quite work because people got mad. Yes.
Another thing to keep in mind was that this form of slavery was to provide a better way of life, especially for the female slaves.
Mm. Yeah, especially if you're looking at in a world where we were talking about widows and orphans, but for ancient societies, for women to just be out on their own, I'm not even talking about ancient societies. Today, there are parts of the world right now where you could say women that are on their own It is a tough, tough slog where they sadly have to sell themselves and not to the kind of owners that we're looking at here today. Their owners are extremely, extremely bad because their owners are not under the Shemitah, the Yobel sort of order to free them, to not beat them, to not use, abuse them, whatever. Not at all. So yeah, I mean, sadly, the flip side of what we see in these destructions here that we're looking at today, that goes on in this very day in parts of this world. So that's, it's extremely sad. And increasingly in this country, we talk about human trafficking as kind of a way to euphemize the horrific sort of slavery that's going on today. We're talking millions and millions of children and teenagers that are being trafficked today, sold, and not to owners that have any sort of inkling, anything of what we're looking at here today. Restrictions upon them? No. Yes?
I forgot you took so long.
Sorry. I apologize. So, that is a good way to say, move on. So we're talking about laws of violence, the laws upon animals. What are things that we can learn about violence? What do we learn about violence? What is this, the instructions that we see in this particular section of chapter 21 about violence? Don't do it. And it talks about eye for eye and tooth for tooth as it is introduced in that part. It's interesting when that's passed along because it mentions that in the same context. Well, if you knock his tooth out, he goes free. If you destroy his eye, he goes free. And it says eye for eye, tooth for tooth. Gets back to that principle. Yeah. Don't do it. If you do not want this kind of violence done to you, you don't do it to someone else. But if that kind of violence is done where you actually are taking a life, that life for life is incredibly serious. But you put this together with what you see at the ending part of the parasha where it's talking about the injunctions upon the Elohim, the Ha-Elohim, the judges, they are having to decide, okay, if someone does a fatal violence upon somebody, what do you do about it? You're not supposed to let the guilty go free, but you're not supposed to condemn the innocent, and especially don't kill the innocent. Wow. So that sort of care goes into it. So when you see in the, it's mentioned about the Sanhedrin that executed someone more than, you know, once in, what is that? I think it's 100 years or something like that. Mentioned it was a bloody one, just the basically a good idiomatic saying of the death penalty was not meted out that often. In fact, when you go through there, you can probably see some of the cases that are in the Torah itself, of the few cases that you do actually have the death penalty meted out. Where, you know, you have the specific example of the, we'll get to it later with the guy who's collecting sticks on the Shabbat. Wow. Yes.
Okay, so when they were in the wilderness, and that's where they're at now,
yes,
they had a certain type of rituals that they did for guilt. Like when the man felt jealous, she had to drink a bunch of scum off the floor. And that was God's way of, if she was innocent, nothing would happen to her. If she wasn't, she would die. But here, you know, it's eye, tooth, tooth, and all that sort of thing. But then in number 30, I'm not really understanding it. They're supposed to be put to death, but it looks like it's saying that somebody can be ransomed. So there's different ways of doing things, it seems like.
Well, so, you know, look at a little bit earlier when it's talking about with a, you know, the rogue animal. Is, you know, after it's talking about eye for an eye, tooth for tooth, you know, knock an eye out, knock a tooth out, person goes free, then it goes into, if you have an ox, gores a man or woman to death. Okay, the ox shall be stoned, and his flesh shall not be eaten. Because you're talking about there was a death that happened here. You've got to acknowledge this. So in that case, it's like the animal did this. It just went rogue and did this. You have to acknowledge that something terrible has happened. A person died because of it. So that is why, you know, sadly, the animal dies because of that. And it's like, it's not even eaten because you're saying, wow, this has really happened to such a degree that this blood guilt has come upon the animal. Okay. Then it goes on further. But if the ox was in the habit of goring and the owner had been warned, okay, this, look at those two layers there. Known to gore. Okay. So this owner knows that it has happened before, that it has hurt people or killed people before. I don't know how it would have escaped the killing people, but at least it hurt people before. But then he was actually warned about it.
Yeah.
Okay, warned, probably, you know, don't know, it doesn't say it specifically, but it may have been down to the warning as a fine, because if you're injuring somebody, you're getting down to the restitution area. But then, if it goes on then, and it kills somebody because of that, then what happens? Yeah, the owner gets put to death along with the animal. If a ransom is demanded of him, then he shall give for the redemption of whose life? His life, whatever is demanded of him. Well, who's coming for the, you could say, the ransom or the restitution? Yeah, the avenger of blood. The avenger of blood is saying, okay, I will let you live, but da-da-da-da-da-da. Yes. So thus, you could say, and a little bit of mercy in that. Remember, we're talking about in the Beatitudes, this avenger of blood was giving a case of mercy and saying, wow, this was, you could say, criminal negligence because he should be dying because of this behavior. But the one who's meeting out the punishment is saying, no, I'll take restitution in this case. Yeah, so it's a case of mercy. And it gets a little bit back to what Paul's injunction was. Paul's injunction is that as much as it relates upon you, to live at peace with other people. So, in this case, do you just throw it to the wall and say, I must have your life? That gets back to what you'd say some of the weightier matters of the law. Justice, mercy, and trust, or faith, as it's talked about. So those, when you're saying that there is a righteousness that's above the law, because the Lord is put out here, this is the testimony of who He is, but also a testimony of who He is what He taught to Moses about there on the mountain. Merciful, forgiving, slow to anger. So then what should we be? Merciful, forgiving, slow to anger. So thus, if, you know, heaven forbid, we're ever in the position of being a, quote, avenger of blood on our case, what then should our approach be? Slow to anger. Merciful. There's the stopgap measure, as it's hinted at here before, with the cities of refuge, where a person can flee to. We'll see much of that later on. But this is an indication that, okay, you've got cities of refuge, but do you really have to use them? Well, if you're the perp, okay, it'd probably behoove you to head fast to the nearest city of refuge. But if you're the Avenger of Blood, do you really need to get blood for blood? Do you really need to? Yes, the Torah says, wow, a death happened, so then a life could be taken. But in this case, ransom. Wow, what does that sound like? That you can take something else. And then when we get into Exodus, the latter part of that spills over into Leviticus. We start seeing the ransoming. The ransoming that happens. And that the person comes into the presence of God through, you could say, a ransom process. That something else is taking your place on its way into the presence of God. You go in, but you're different. Because you become the korban. You become the offering as it goes in into the presence of God.
Well, I was just going to kind of go along with what you both said. And it's, you know, the Torah is designed to ultimately lead us to life or protect life. And if we look at the case where my bull gets out and gores my neighbor and kills him, I'm not sincerely guilty of that on the first term. I mean, I didn't train this bull to go out and gore my neighbor because I don't like my neighbor, and this is my way of killing this man. The bull got out, the guy ran, he charged, whatever. So the ability to be able to ransom my debt just shows the justness of the Torah, the justness of the gospel, the justness of the mishpat. In other words, everything was designed to lead us to life, not to death. And the ransom is my ability, because I had no guilt. I had no, you know, I've done nothing wrong. But yet something happened that is wrong. So something needs to be taken care of.
You have to acknowledge
justice for the unjust. And so then I am able to ransom or pay that family for their loss, for what happened. And however that's done, you know, would be done through the judges or through the community or through the society. Or, I mean, they knew what, you know, what was the right course of action. And it just, you know, I was going to wait to the end to bring it up, but I won't bore you guys all with that then. And I'll just say, it's just amazing to me how, you know, Christianity would say that, you know, the law, the Mosaic laws are done away with and then convict us by the Ten Commandments and not understand that, you know, when God said, thou shalt not murder, that's fine and dandy, but then he went farther and gave us the beautiful instructions of what that meant and included all these wonderful, beautiful ordinances to clear our minds and to give us understanding, you know, and to allow, I mean, it's just amazing to me, you know, the Mosaic laws or however you want to look at the Mishpat, how that just gives such clarity and allows them to expunge and grow on all these things that are occurring within their government, within their society, within their families. And I mean, I look at it as a beautiful thing and how it was, everything was designed just to be just and righteous.
Yeah.
Mishpat and Zedek.
Which is why you end up seeing Mishpat used in many cases along with Zedek. And tzedakah, the righteous and righteousness, because those go together, just as we saw that Messiah talked about in Matthew chapter 5. So one of the things that we can see here in Exodus 21 is that you have to acknowledge that something horrifically terrible has happened, either with an injury or death. You have to acknowledge that, because you have to realize that God sees this as incredibly serious, because he is the author of life, and that you've had injury and death, anger, whatever has crept into society to create the situation. and or negligence. You're not thinking, you know, when you talk about love your neighbor as yourself, well, then maybe control your dangerous stuff. Control your dangerous stuff so that it doesn't become dangerous and kill somebody. So, you know, when you talk about today, you put forth a good faith effort. If you sadly say something terrible happens, people come back, well, did you take precautions? Did you put up the orange cones? As we go in there, did you put up the little boundary around the edge of your top of your roof so people don't fall off and stuff like that? Did you take precautions in dangerous situations? Were you looking out for somebody else? Or are you just saying, well, I have the right to do this, so I'm just going to do it. And if they die, well, okay. You know, I'll get my pass on the first goring, but uh-oh, look out on the second one. So, or do we say, well, let's try not to have the first goring actually happen. Looking out for our neighbor, just like we want our neighbor to look out for us. Did you also see in there about, we're going to get to it in the next section, about laws of property in chapter 22 of Exodus. Did you see in there about the injunctions on your enemy? You know, people think that Yeshua was perverting something when he said, love your enemies. Where does it ever say that in the Torah? Right here. Love your enemies. If your enemies, well, what does it say? If the enemy's cow, the guy who has something against you, gets off and you see it, what do you do with it? Take it in your house and sell it. Chop it up for steaks. He owes me. Yeah. No, it's not the poor animal's fault whose owner it was, but the injunction is for us to look out for even those people who hate us. And you could say in the first part, you could almost say that even someone who you, quote, hate or dislike, someone just you can't stand, you look out for those people's stuff just as if it were your own. And in there, about someone entrusting something to you, I mean, some of the stuff today, it seems like kind of odd that people leave their this or that with you. But yeah, I mean, today we might call it rentals. I mean, there was just a thing today about a particular large brand of apparel company that is dramatically changing their return policy. They're changing their return policy because people are bringing back stuff years, sometimes decades after they bought it. Or they didn't even buy it, they got it at a garage sale. And then they take it back and say, hey, look, you got this return policy, no questions asked. Here it is, it's in tatters, it's a pile of crap, but I want my money back. You're like, are you looking out for someone else? Would you want someone else to do that to you? You know, you, they're back to our proverbial Ferrari again. You know, you go out and you go joyriding with your friend's Ferrari and they give you and you trash it and this and that and the other and you take it back and, well, here it is. Here's your Ferrari. Can't drive it. Yeah. To be afraid that we ding the Ferrari. I mean, good grief. You'd probably have to mortgage your house just to pull a dent out. But one of the things that we also kind of fits into this is the thing you'll see in Ecclesiastes as well as some of the other places about, you know, work as if you're working for the Lord. Because one of the things that we could say of a contract that we have with our employers, if we work for somebody, or if we're self-employed and we have a contract with somebody, we're working for that person, for that particular job or whatever, how are we treating the things that have been, quote, lent or given to us? Are we over-delivering back value back to them? Over-delivering in, you know, as they say, one of the things I always have to remember with, you know, my own job is, you could say, under-promise and over-deliver. Under-promise and over-deliver. Because what? If you over-promise and under-deliver, what happens? Well, you get in trouble, but you don't get more business, you get fired, this and that and the other, but what also happens to, number one, your word? Trashed. Your word becomes trashed. So if you're known as someone in your workplace who overpromises and underdelivers. And then you start talking about the God of Israel. What is someone going to listen to you? They're like, you know, what has this God of Israel done for you? You can't even keep your word. Now, what about all these promises and blah, 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 and stuff you keep telling me about all the time? What does that mean? If that's the person you follow, I don't want to have anything to do with them. You hear that about our brothers and sisters in faith all the time. And sadly, sometimes we even hear it about ourselves. It's a sad... Yeah, back to if your light is darkness, wow, how great is that darkness that you get there in like John chapter 3, I think it is, where he talks about your light. So, that's one of the lessons that we get here in talking about with our Mishpatim here in dealing with other people's property. You treat other people the way you'd want to be treated. So, love God with all your heart, soul, and your strength, your stuff. That's a way of loving God. So, chapter 23. So as we keep going in here, and it just throws in here these items about Shabbat, and we talked already about the Shemitah. What on earth does this have to do with anything in here about what the things related to Shabbat and the Shemitah? Why would this be in here in this section? You'd say that kind of the baby giving of the Torah, where in a few chapters you get kind of an encapsulation. Yes? Chapter 21.
If the ox gores a male or female slave, he is to pay 30 shekels of silver to the master, and the ox to be stoned. And I'm wondering, you see 30 pieces of silver with Joseph, you see 30 pieces of silver with Yeshua. I'm like, there's got to be something going on, a connection somehow.
Yeah, sometimes often seen as like a slave price. Because you see it referred to in some other Near Eastern documents where they mention a similar amount of silver or money. So you get that association down. Wow. Even Messiah sold for 30 pieces of silver. Who's the ox? Is it Judas or somebody? One of the key things to look at that is that the idea of ransom. It's very interesting when we talk about a sale of a slave, but also a ransom price. Sale of a slave and a ransom price. So when we look at Messiah said what? I came to ransom for many. Came not to be served, but to serve. A servant, our master, came with the idea, with the persona, the mission statement of a servant to serve. So thus, as our master has done, so we do as well. We also serve. So thus, what you're seeing in these instructions is to serve. That's why when it talks about when you come up to the feast three times a year, show up empty-handed, right? Do not show up empty-handed. Why is that? Because you need to pile up more stuff in the temple. You need to stuff the temple full of stuff. To share with the poor and the community, but it's also when we talk about respecting our leaders, respecting our parents. That's what you're seeing. Where do we come from? Where is, you could say, the flow of the message, the authority of God, where does it come down into society through? So by coming back with the things that we have been blessed with at these particular times in the year, like when it talks about coming up three times a year, you see further explanations of that in Numbers, but you're coming up during harvest periods. So these are times that the Lord has blessed you. And it goes on in greater detail. You bring up the blessings that you've been blessed with. Yes? To honor God.
To recognize and acknowledge that when we have everyone is God's child, and we are to share with them what we have if we can.
Yes, to share. Oh, would we want someone to do that? to us if we didn't have? If we were hungry, we were in prison, would we want someone to visit us, to take care of us? We didn't have this or that, would we want someone to do that? Yeah, we would. We would want someone to do that for us. So thus, we also bless other people and bring that forward. So it gives you an idea as to, well, this is not kind of randomly thrown in there. This is a whole part of how you treat other people, the festivals. I think it's all about you and just that the Creator, you know, has some sort of a, you know, lust for people to show up. No, it's about loving back and forth between the Creator and the created. And then between the people who are created, realizing where it all comes from and where our allegiance belongs. And acknowledging that, just like we were acknowledging with the death of somebody with a gored animal or an animal that gores, or you have someone who's beating someone else. You know, even with you, that's an interesting situation where you have a premature birth caused during a fight where people are fighting. You have to acknowledge that something terrible has happened. And that's, you know, like, oh, well, we have to acknowledge, yeah, that something bad has happened and we don't want something like that to be going on anymore. Because otherwise, if we just say, oh, I'll just pay the fine, it becomes like the heresy of indulgences. You just pay it, you know, basically get credit. You pay up your account so you can take it down. That's kind of in the flippant sense of it. And the other sense of it is you actually teach people that, wow, you can actually pay your way out of your bad behavior. You behave badly, and then you can pay your way out of it. Is that kind of the testimony that we have of the Creator? Is that we just bribe? We bribe the Elohim. And things go well. We get the judgment in our favor. That's actually what we have here in this passage. Do we, you know, it says, bribe the judges. Bribe the judges. Does it say that? No, it says exactly the opposite. Do not bribe the judges. Why? It will blind them. It will blind them from being able to see it. And then you also have it in that the judges are not to skew what they decide based upon what? The person's socioeconomic status, their privilege or not privilege, or on and on it goes.
I was just going to say that, you know, even when you go back to when Moshe went to get his wife and kids and meet the priest out in the desert, and he says, oh, you're doing all these judgments. He says, you need to get guys to help you. What'd you say? Oh, okay. Well, yes. I wasn't here. But anyways, you know, right there, he says to him, make sure you appoint men that you can't bribe.
Right. People that are not persuaded by things that will just pick the right behavior and the way it goes. Because at the end, it ends with this passage of all the elders going up the mountain to receive the tablets of this testimony. Receive the tablets of the testimony. And then you also have this injunction in there about saying, everything that you have said, we will do. That's what the people said. Twice. They said that twice. Even it gives it more emphatically the second time. Oh, we're going to do it. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Everything you said, we are going to do. And then the golden calf. This comes in our next passage after that. But one of those things, we were kind of talking a little bit about the northern kingdom and things that went askew up there with different set of holy days and even a different, totally different picture, different testimony of God. It's always important to go back to where the starting point is for these instructions. Are we, when we make judgments, are we interested in judgment Are we interested in justice, the things that are right, or do we just want to win? Do we just want to beat someone down just because we win? Or do we want what is just? Are we going to be the avenger of blood who takes the ransom instead of the life? Are we going to be able to let it go ourselves and say, vengeance is yours, Lord, not mine? So I hope that what we can see here when we kind of peek under the hood of these instructions is why it is that when Yeshua said all of the law and the prophets hang upon these things, love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul and your strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. That is why these things hang on those two items. And why we have to keep going back to those two instructions, those two commandments. Every time we look at any of these things and wonder, why on earth is that in there? What is that teaching us about those two commandments? Loving God and loving other people. So hopefully in that we will all become, when it talks about there, that eventually we'll be in the new world judging angels, judging the nations and such, that we will learn what it means to be Ha Elohim, to be the judges. And why we should be very, very slow in this time now to try to become Ha Elohim, the judges. To realize where our gates end and where other people's gates begin. So, yes.
Well, it seems like, you know, the Most High is the judge. You know,
yes.
Like Jesus is the judge. But we have standards. Like, this is
That's the standard. Yes.
We don't need to judge an individual's heart. You know, like, that's up to, only he knows
the
heart of an individual. But we can, like, set forth and execute the standard of Torah. And that is what, you know, it's, that's what we, that's all, you know, we can do, really. Because I just see it as a really spiritual thing. Like, you know, vengeance is, belongs to him.
Right.
And he is the judge. So he's going to give the people each according to their own works and deeds what is just.
Yeah.
So.
And you see that in some examples, like in 1 Corinthians, where you have a situation where, you know, one person in the community was behaving egregiously in a situation where even people on the outside of the people of God would look at that and go, wow, that's reprehensible, even for Corinth, which was known as not a great, how do you say, bastion of righteousness. Even they would look at that and go, wow, that's reprehensible. So thus, just for the sake of the community there, and for the sake of the community's witness in Corinth, they had to say, I'm sorry, you have to go. And you know, thankfully, we get the other side of the story in 2 Corinthians, where that judgment, that mishpat, that Paul instructed that congregation to take, it had its effect to say, wow, this person turned around and came back. And that turnaround is what we want. We want to be turned around, not to beat down or beat other people down. Yes, if you do not, you could say various ways you could translate that, but if you don't see or perceive the body of Messiah in there and what that actually means, you know, when you are going forward with Pesach, wow, that is an egregious thing, because you are not even seeing that is, just as it was in the first Pesach, that Yeshua is the one who blocks the wrath of God. There was a kind of a nice Pesach discussion that the Lord sends the destroyer, but then the Lord also blocks the destroyer. And the one who blocks the destroyer is stronger than the destroyer. Hallelujah. Yeah. Yes. Let's close in prayer. Father God, we thank you for giving us the testimony of your witnesses throughout time that give us a true picture of who you are. And Father, we ask for you to continually change us, to fill us up with your Spirit, that we will choose the right way and not the wrong way, and be lights and salt in the world around us. We thank you for teaching us through all these things in the name of your Son, Yeshua. Amen.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hallel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions or if you have any questions, visit the website at hallel.info. That's H-A-L-L-E-L.info. Hallel.info.